And I'll remember that summer as the summer I was taking steroids, because you like a man with muscles, and I like you. That's the Front Bottoms. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. Did not think I would get to use that lyric this season, but of course, the story from yesterday, Toronto Blue Jays prospect, number two prospect in the system, top 50 prospect in all of baseball, Orelvis Martinez, called up, makes his Major League debut shortly after he is popped with an 80-game suspension under Major League Baseball's PED policy. He has declined to appeal. He's kind of admitted and explained his side of it in a statement through MLBPA. Ross Atkins and John Schneider reacted to it yesterday down in Cleveland as the Blue Jays, by the way, were in the process of getting swept for a second consecutive series. They have lost six in a row. They're seven games under 500. They're 6.5 back of a wild card spot. They're heading into Boston for three more here against one of the hottest teams in baseball. And if they survive that, they'll come back here for four against one of the best teams in the league in the New York Yankees. Things are bleak across the board. Let's see how Shai Davidi feels about it. He joins us now of Sportsnet, of Sportsnet.ca. Shai, good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. And Blake, that was a pretty good summation of the tsunami of misery this team is facing right now.
And I didn't even mention George Springer or Jordan Romano having a setback. There's we can build on this, Shai. We can go a whole half hour on this. Let's start with Orelvis, though. I know you weren't in Cleveland. You were doing Blue Jay Central back here, but you had a lot of great stuff on it on Blue Jay Central yesterday. Can you walk us through a little bit what the last maybe 48 hours would have been like process-wise and kind of, ripple-wise in the organization?
Well, it would have been a little bit more than just 48 hours, because that test would have taken place in the minor leagues, just given the logistics involved with everything. So before he got up, he would have taken a test at some point. And then you've got the transporting of the sample, the testing of the sample, the reading of the sample, the exchange of information. And the process, initially at least, it does not involve the team at all. It is between the player, Major League Baseball, and the players union, and they'll go through the different options. The player has the chance to appeal if he so chooses. In this case, Orelvis Martinez decided not to appeal. And then at that point, once the decision is levied, then the club is brought into the process. And so that all played out, the latter part all played out over the weekend in Cleveland. Orelvis Martinez on Saturday, according to Ross Atkins, met with him and the manager and broke the news to them. And at that point, they proceeded forward from there.
So a tough one, obviously, for those who didn't catch the details of it and care. The drug in question was clomiphene, which is primarily used in women's fertility drugs on the estrogen receptors. But according to the USADA, in men, it can alter testosterone levels by interfering with the negative feedback loop of the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. Obviously, as surely everyone knows, Orelvis said that he and his girlfriend have been trying to get pregnant, and he was prescribed a fertility drug to help with that, but he didn't disclose it to the team or to Major League Baseball's Players Association due to privacy. He did take full responsibility for his negligence and accepted his suspension, as mentioned in a statement through MLBPA. So he will not appeal. Ross Atkins and John Schneider, a little, obviously there's not much they can say in a situation like yesterday. What did you make of the comments that they could make, though? It did seem via them that there is some contrition on the part of Orelvis Martinez, and it didn't seem like, his standing necessarily will change much here. They just want to make sure that he's well educated on it and this doesn't happen again.
Well, I think that's all the kind of standard stuff, right? Yeah. And ultimately, this is pretty damaging for the Blue Jays, right? It's a half a year of development for Orelvis Martinez that he's losing. It removes from the Blue Jays, overall roster, organizational roster, someone who could have been a potential impact contributor in the relative near term. And it also takes away some of their prime trade currency or prospect currency for trades should they want to try to add in some way, shape, or form. So, I mean, it's deeply damaging. And so when they say disappointment, I think that's a lot of what they're referring to there. But obviously, you've got an asset in distress. You've got to try to protect that asset. And again, this is someone who could have tremendous importance to this organization, because he has the type of power that very few players in general do, and very few players in the Blue Jays system do. And so they need him to turn into something for them. And so they've got to rally around him and try to help him in every manner possible. And look, this has happened before to prospects in the Blue Jays system. Marcus Stroman went through this when he was in Double A, I believe, or maybe in High A. Can't remember the level, but this happened to him as well on his way up, and he was able to overcome that and move forward. And the Blue Jays will certainly hope that that's the same case for Aroldis Martinez here. But again, in the short term, incredibly damaging for a team that can ill afford to have these kinds of losses right now because of the situation that they're in.
Yeah, it's a good point, Shai. And look, you know, there are, you know, let's say to be broad, there are three paths the Blue Jays could take from here. One is you trade to try to get better. And like you said, Aroldis Martinez would have been one of the key pieces. He can't be a part of that path really anymore. One is you sell and you bought him out, and it's kind of a youth movement, and he would have been one of the key pieces people wanted to see in the lineup every day. In that scenario, he's not a part of that scenario. And then there's the kind of middle ground where, well, you're just trying to get a little better in the interim and see if you can turn this thing around. And potentially he was a part of that, at least for a couple days here. So for anyone unfamiliar with the process, Aroldis now goes on the restricted list, which doesn't count as a roster spot, doesn't count as a 40-man spot. So he is just not a part of the picture roster-wise for the next 80 Major League games. He can, though, Shai, be with the team down at the Dunedin complex or their Dominican complex. What does that side of things look like procedurally from here? Like, is this, for, as far as his development goes, obviously he can't be in games, which are the most important thing, but is this kind of like the equivalent of, hey, he's on the developmental list that we sometimes see minor league guys go on? You can take BP, you can work out, that kind of stuff. You just can't be around game action?
Essentially, that's it. So you can consider him sort of a player on the developmental list, or like a player who's rehabbing from injury. You get all this work in, except you cannot play in any sort of real games. And so the Blue Jays will try, I'm sure, to simulate as much real competition for him as possible. They'll try to find other ways for him to make the most of that time and benefit from it. But those real in-game at-bats, the cat-and-mouse situations with pitchers, reading situations, all the little subtleties that would really help him make the jump from the AAA to the big league level, all that stuff is on hold. So the Blue Jays will undoubtedly try to be at their creative best and terms of creating developmental opportunities for him, but this is, none of this is ideal, right? This is all sort of making chicken salad out of chicken poop for a player in this situation, and just trying to find ways to help him and speed the process once he is ready to go.
So you mentioned this is not the first time this has happened. Marcus Stroman went through it. Thomas Pannone, if you go back a little further, Alan Farinha, like this has happened in the Blue Jays system. This has happened, you know, Aroldis Martinez is the eighth suspension in Major League Baseball this season. I believe he's only the second one that happened while a player was on a Major League roster, Noel V. Marte being the other one. But this happens from a preventative standpoint. And I don't say this to put the blame on the Blue Jays. This is just for the education of the listener. What resources are in place? I know the MLB and MLBPA provide educational programs in both English and Spanish to try to prevent this. What do the Blue Jays do internally to try to educate and avoid these kind of scenarios with their young players?
Yeah, I mean, all three parties in terms of the clubs, in this case, the Blue Jays, Major League Baseball and the Players Association are involved in getting this information to players, doing presentations, providing sort of these educational opportunities. But ultimately, it's up to the player to be forthright with the team and let them know, hey, I'm in this situation. I've been prescribed this. Does this fit within the banned substance list? Right. And these lists are made available to players. They're shared with them. They're shared with agents. They're shared with everybody. And you can look them up yourself in terms of am I taking something that might have a cost? You know, even you look at sir, the clomiphene, which is what Orelvis Martinez got tested positive for, you go to the USADA site, which you quoted earlier, and one of the things it says in terms of why it's banned is that, and I'm quoting here, clomiphene has also appeared as an undeclared ingredient in black market products sold on the internet for performance-enhancing use, right? So you've got to be careful because these products can get into all these different places in terms of substances that are being marketed and sold to try and give people a boost. So you have to be extremely careful. Players understand that. It's being reinforced to them. And ultimately, it comes down to the player being forthright with the club. And if you have any doubt, you have to make sure. And I think that's one of the lessons that you can take from this. If you're a player in the Blue Jay system, don't leave anything to chance, even if it's something personal and private, which is what Orelvis Martinez has told us. You still are responsible for everything that gets ingested into your body. And we've heard the inadvertent doping excuses from athletes across the years. I didn't know. The standard is very clear to everybody that you have to be aware of every single thing that goes into your body. It is a burden on players and athletes, no doubt, but that is part of the responsibility that you take on for this career.
It is, and you know, fortunately for Orelvis, in his case, he's young and has a lot of time to learn from this and better from this. You know, some guys like Chris Colabello never gets another chance after something like that because he's a little older and was on the fringes anyway. So certainly hope from here that Orelvis Martinez learns from it and the organization can kind of move forward with him after these 80 games are up. Shy, those 80 games, they will not have Orelvis Martinez. At least like 20 of those games are going to be pretty high leverage in terms of keeping this thing from getting sucked down the drain here. Like, it's circling pretty hard here. They've lost six in a row. First time this year they've lost six in a row. Consecutive sweeps. Worst record they've had since 2019. I know it's very, very early to look at these things, but the Fangraphs playoff odds have them down around 5%. What is your sense of, and I know we heard from Ross Atkins yesterday, and it was the same thing we heard on the May long weekend. It was the same thing we heard at the end of the 2023 season. You know, what is he going to say otherwise at this point? But what is your sense of where the organization is in terms of this thing had, like, this isn't their hanging around 500 and they're two games out of a wild card spot anymore. This hole has gotten significantly larger since the last time we talked to Ross Atkins publicly.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten significantly larger last week, right? Yeah. Like last Monday, the Blue Jays were a win away from 500, feeling pretty good after taking two or three from Cleveland, coming off a good stretch against some bottom-feeding clubs where they looked to be on the verge of rescuing their season, and all that is gone in the blink of an eye. So, look, I think the situation for the Blue Jays, in a lot of ways, hasn't really changed, or at least the calculus, right? You're still playing things out towards the deadline and letting the club dictate what you do from there. I think what's moved is just the reality of the situation. And you know, it is early to look at playoff odds, but it's pretty indicative of what this team is facing right now. The fact that it's 5% according to Fangraphs. I mean, that's a really huge mountain for them to climb. Doesn't mean that it's impossible for them to climb, but there are a lot of headwinds that they're facing. You look at the run differential, that's minus 50 so far. And if anything, they're playing a bit above what their run differential says that they should be. That, you know, that's not an underlying stat that says a turnaround is imminent here. And so as this moves along and those numbers don't change, it pushes the Blue Jays further and further towards a sell at this deadline. And, you know, that my sense right now is that it would be the expiring contracts that would be sold off and with an eye towards regrouping towards 2025. But who knows how things may change, right? Things can get better. Things can get worse. And ultimately, a big part of this becomes what is available to you from other teams. And so the Blue Jays could potentially, if they have to sell, end up in a situation that is advantageous, because there's so many teams that are hanging around both the American League and National League wildcard races. There are a lot of teams that are just really, really mid and are going to be close enough that they may not want to sell to take a shot at it. And so that could very much turn into a seller's market that the Blue Jays may want to capitalize on. On the flip side, they could get hot. Bo Bichette could return. He could take off along with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Maybe George Springer comes around. The odds say that's a low probability right now, but it's on the table. So the Blue Jays play it out and before making a final decision.
Yeah, 20 games to go before the All-Star break, which is kind of unofficially the point at which you should have an idea if you're buying or selling in those 2 weeks coming out of the All-Star break. Those 20 games include 3 more against the Red Sox, 4 against the Yankees, 4 against the Astros, who had a nice weekend here in sweeping the Orioles and are trying to do the same thing the Jays are doing, which is get it out of the drain, get back to being a modest buyer. So the schedule not particularly easy. And as our colleague Arden Zwelling pointed out in an article yesterday, the Jays would have to win at a 97-win pace the rest of the way to get to 86 wins. 86 wins right now would not get you into the playoffs based on the projected standings. It would get you back in the mix. It would get you back in that range. But that's the context we're dealing with here. You have to play like basically a 100-win team the rest of the way to make up the ground that you've already dug. And I don't know that there's a lot here that says this team can play at a 100-win pace for half a season here. So, Shai, if they're going to do that, if they're going to make the most of these next 20 games and keep the front office from being at least mild sellers, you mentioned one of the ways they could do that, which is Bo Bichette comes back and looks a little better. He's going to do a full pregame workout before today's game in Boston. If all goes well, he'll be reactivated tomorrow. The other question mark kind of hanging over everything, and we've talked about it a lot, but after the weekend that was, we could talk about it a little bit more. Shai, George Springer has the worst OPS, on-base percentage plus slugging percentage, of any qualified hitter in baseball. Not only does he have the worst of any qualified hitter this year, but among quarter outfielders, going back 100 years, he has the worst OPS of any qualified corner outfielder. And as Chris Black pointed out on Twitter, the guys who are up there on that list are guys who were like good glove and high stolen base guys. George Springer is, we can acknowledge he's better than this. Things would turn around. He's gotten pinched on some strike threes. He's had some bad batted ball luck, etc. But we're talking about the worst performance offensively at his position in like 100 years, and he's still in there every day. At what point is John Schneider going to, if ever, move off of Springer being in there as an everyday piece right now?
I don't know that there's a definitive date or what it is that you do. But I think as long as the Blue Jays are trying to rescue their season, they have to try and have George Springer come around, because the odds of them rescuing their season without some sort of meaningful contribution from him aren't especially high. And I understand that he hasn't performed and to this point and has been, you know, one of the reasons they're in the situation that they're in. But it's not like they're just have tons of options, right? A lot of their depth has one. A lot of their depth is at the big league level now, right? They've already sort of used a lot of those, or pulled a lot of those, or broken a lot of in case of emergency switches. They've already hit those. And then some other guys who could come around, someone like a Nathan Lucas, for instance. I mean, he suffered a thumb injury, underwent surgery, and his season is essentially over. And so, and you know, Aroldis Martinez is in that mix too, where like, okay, well, this is a guy who could have been a piece for you, but he's out of the mix as well. And so the Blue Jays have just continually lost options, and their alternatives aren't necessarily better versus relative to the value that you could get if George Springer is able to find something and lock in and perform to some degree a lot of what he's been in the past. So I think that's really the balance that the Blue Jays are clinging to right now. They need him to come around. They're working hard with him to help him come around. He's working hard to try and come around. It's not happening. But it's not like they have a ton of alternatives that are going to be better. And you're invested in him too, right? I mean, there's still two more seasons at roughly $50 million after this one, looming for George Springer. So if you can't find a way to repair him, you know, this isn't just a now problem. This is a problem into the next 2 years as well.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And yeah, like I said, there are reasonable cases to be made that he will bounce back. I've lost the kind of confidence he's going to bounce back to be George Springer. But, you know, if you could get that back to a 700 OPS, which is, we're lowering the bar so much. But, you know, that's what Justin Turner's been able to do over the last couple of weeks. And we're not talking about him not being in the lineup every day anymore. They just need more from this. And, you know, probably it should mean, you know, an extra Barger day here and there, an extra Horwitz day here and there. But, yeah, it's a tough spot, Shai. And like you said, if they're going to get where they're going, we can understand that they want George Springer to be a part of that. Tough month, though. Tough month indeed. 431 OPS in June, and based on win probability added, because he has come up in some very high leverage spots, about 1.2 wins. And this isn't wins above replacement. This is based on, like, hey, you came up with two on and one out, and what are your chances of winning then? Oh, innings over. What are your chances of winning now? 1.2 wins in June there. It's been a tough one. Jordan Romano also suffered a setback on the weekend.
Blake,
shot.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Before you go there, just one other point that I will make.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned Justin Turner there, and, you know, both he and George ended up getting sick at the same time, mm-hmm. and being really sapped by it. And it's interesting that their numbers really kind of cratered almost at the same time as they were sick together. Justin Turner maybe has recovered a little bit earlier. And I think that's another piece that the Blue Jays are hoping for, too, that as George Springer gets further away from that illness, maybe that helps him and he returns to full energy the way Justin Turner has.
Yeah, that would be a hope, because Turner, at least the last week, has been, you know, he's looked like a different Turner. 7 hits and 5 walks over his last 5 games here. I'm sure they would love to have that. And that's a good point, Shai, that did. You know, that wrecked a couple of guys in those clubhouse, in that clubhouse there. So good point on that. Jordan Romano suffered a setback on the weekend. Felt more elbow soreness. He's been shut down. Per Arden, he's not being sent for imaging just yet. Shai, again, I know you weren't there on the weekend, but your read on the concern level that the Jays might have there, or that we should have there, especially given, obviously, the cascading effect here of Jimmy Garcia is also on the IL. Eric Swanson has an ERA of like 17 at AAA. Tough time at the back of the bullpen.
Yeah, definitely. And look, I think the concern level should have started when he went for a second cortisone shot, right? That means the first one either didn't take or didn't do enough to alleviate the concerns that he was experiencing. And the thing with cortisone shots is that if they don't end up in exactly the right spot where some of the inflammation or pain is, then they aren't particularly effective. And if Jordan Romano is still experiencing some problems, I mean, this starts becoming not just a now problem, but again, a problem into next season, because he is one of the players that for the Blue Jays has an expiring contract next year. And you would look at him saying, okay, well, if we have him for 2025, well, we can regroup with some of our core and make some changes and perhaps take another shot at this. But if you take Jordan Romano out of the mix, you know, Jimmy Garcia and Trevor Richards are pending free agents. All of a sudden, you know, Eric Swanson isn't right. You can't be sure what you've got in him. Same with Tim Mayza. All of a sudden, it's like, well, we don't have a bullpen. And that's a major issue. And then it's also a lot of this becomes a matter of asset management as well, right? That if you're not going to be able to extend Jordan Romano and you might not be competitive next year, then you have to be able to trade him and help replenish your system. And the Blue Jays are already experiencing that right now, that they need to get Jimmy Garcia back on the field. And, you know, I've had conversations with people from other clubs who are wondering exactly where Jimmy Garcia is at and how severe it is, because that is something that a lot of teams are going to be keeping an eye on. The Blue Jays are going to want him able pitching and sort of showcasing himself for the trade market. They're going to want Yusei Kikuchi in that spot as well. All their expiring contracts, they're going to want performing as well as possible. And so if Jordan Romano is in this spot where he's got some uncertain health issues and unable to perform, It's both damaging now and both damaging into next year. And in terms of trying to keep, for the Blue Jays, trying to keep that asset alive at some point.
All right, let's end on a bit more of a positive here, Shai. I'd imagine this would have come up more while you were on Blue Jay Central had the Arelvis stuff not been going on as well. Spencer Horwitz comes up with two home runs yesterday. Really nice play at second base. I know he's a guy that you've been really, really impressed with since he came up, both at the plate and in the field.
You know, I don't know that we're appreciating enough how insane it is that Spencer Horwitz has played 18 games or had played 18 games over five or six professional seasons at second base, and then it's coming up and is performing at second base at the big league level. And not only that, he makes a great double play turn in the third inning there. It's a strong, he takes a good feed from Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, a strong turn, strong throw, and then he's got the diving play on a rocket from Jose Ramirez. It's 101 miles an hour off the bat, and he's getting the out there. It's really remarkable what he's been able to do, and then to perform offensively on top of that. You know, I'm not sure power is going to be his signature. He's going to be a hitter first with some power, but the Blue Jays will definitely take that. And, you know, just like David Schneider a year ago, Spencer Horwitz is here and is trying to force his way into more playing time. And he's doing a great job of that thus far,
which is a lot of fun. It's nice to have some positives going on. I'd imagine he'll be near the top of that lineup and at first or second or DH most of this Red Sox series as the Jays try to get back on track down at Fenway. Shai Davidi, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Blake. Be well, dude.
Shai Davidi of Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca. Great job on Blue Jay Central yesterday in a very sharp suit. A couple of updates for you before we continue on with the show. By the way, we're going to talk to Gabrielle Starr of the Boston Herald about the Red Sox side of this series. Doug Fox of the Future Blue Jays newsletter, Blue Jays and MLB photographer Colton Hall joining us a little later. We're also going to give away some tickets to that Jays-Yankees series. That is a threat. We will make you go to a Jays-Yankees game. Some updates from the weekend as well, though, before we do all of that. Start with Joey Votto. He has mysteriously not played in a minor league game since Wednesday, and we haven't been able to get an update on why. He played two Florida Complex League games and one game at Dunedin, and we haven't seen him since. We don't really know why. Ricky Tiedemann on Thursday made his latest rehab start at single A. He went two shutout innings, no hits, no walks, four strikeouts. He'll probably make another rehab start before he's back at AAA and then eventually, hopefully, back on the Major League radar. Down at AAA, Eric Pardino, who we've been tracking and who got the promotion there, had a bit of a rough weekend as every Bisons game has been like a 20 to 15 score lately. Chad Dallas had a nice start in his return from the IL. Eric Swanson really continues to struggle. ERA up around 16 or 17. With an eye toward some relief pitching depth at AAA, the Blue Jays claimed Jose Juas off of waivers from the Cubs and sent him to AAA on the weekend. Obviously not the type of move that's going to move the needle a ton. Very similar to Joel Cornell when they grabbed him, or Ryan Burr, who's popped up in the Major League bullpen and been extra AAA depth. He has decent numbers over the last 2 years in a Major League bullpen, but he's struggled at both the Major League level and the AAA level this year. Gets some swing and miss, but probably too many walks and a lot of hard contact there. Just another depth arm if the Blue Jays have to churn their bullpen over the course of this 17 games in 17 day stretch. And they might have to churn that bullpen because they had to use five different bullpen arms yesterday. They obviously had to lean on Bowden Francis and Tim Mesa for longer outings on Friday because Yariel Rodriguez went fewer than two innings. Yesterday, not entirely the fault of Yusei Kikuchi. There was a rain delay that kind of caused them to go to the bullpen for longer than possible. But if you're looking at what the bullpen looks like today against Boston, Trevor Richards probably available, but maybe a bit yellow because he's pitched two of the last 3 days and a pretty high pitch count yesterday. Cabrera probably not available after pitching a good number of pitches 2 days in a row. Bowden Francis probably fringy, having thrown 74 pitches on Friday. Brandon Little's pitched 2 days in a row, things like that. It kind of adds up. And then, Yariel Rodriguez. The Jays, by the way, have a TBA for their starter for every game this series. They haven't announced their starters yet, but it looks like Bassett, Gausman, Yariel Rodriguez. That Yariel Rodriguez game on Wednesday, of course, a pseudo bullpen game, because even if he's good, you know, he has generally only been stretched out to four, maybe five innings, given the pitch efficiency, inefficiency there, and things like that. Jordan Romano shut down over the weekend. Next steps to be determined. Jimmy Garcia played catch on Saturday, felt good afterwards. Bo Bichette aiming for a return Tuesday. He'll do a full workout pregame today to see how he's feeling. Dalton Varsho was hurt in Saturday's game, dealt with lower back tightness. He felt better Sunday. He didn't play, but you know, it doesn't sound like he'll need an IL stint. And then, yeah, the last one is with Arelvis' suspension and Bo Bichette still on the IL. Stuart Baroa, who we actually talked about a bunch on the show on Friday, got the call up. Really fun player near the top of the International League in stolen bases with 29. Good combination of glove and speed. Doesn't swing and miss a ton, but also strikes out probably a little bit more than you'd like. He's still, you know, even though he's 25, he's still in that finishing school part of AAA, trying to play his way into maybe being a fourth outfielder in the future. Cool to see him up as a pinch runner slash defensive replacement in the interim. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Gabriel Starr of the Boston Herald gives us the Red Sox side of this series. They won another series on the weekend. They are 4-0-3 over their last seven series. They are back into a wild card position in the American League standings. Tough time for the Blue Jays to run into them at Fenway. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays swept over the weekend. Things are bad, bad, bad. Six losses in a row, seven games under 500, and that wild card spot flittering away. That wild card spot, by the way, the last one, is now held by the Boston Red Sox, who are red hot. They are the polar opposite of the Blue Jays. Just swept the Blue Jays last week, and we'll get a chance to do that again down at Fenway Park this week. We're now joined by Gabriel Starr of the Boston Herald to get to know this Sox team a little bit. Gabrielle, good morning. Welcome. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
So what's it like covering a team that's playing really well? Haven't lost a series in seven series. You know, they beat the Phillies, the Yankees, the Jays, now the Reds. Must feel very different than how my job over here feels right now.
It probably does, but the last three of the last 4 years, I have known exactly how you feel. So it's not fun. I feel for you.
It's okay. We persevere. It's still a fun job. For this Red Sox team though, what's clicked lately? I know, you know, it's a team that came in with kind of muddled expectations, new front office. Would they buy? Would they sell? How young are they going? Things like that. But over the last month or so, whatever they've been doing seems to be working.
You know, I think that there's this misconception there's this idea that top prospects have to come up and perform immediately. And as we've seen with Jackson Holliday and plenty of other top prospects over the years, there's a huge adjustment period. And I think for a lot of these young Red Sox players, and Alex Cora has said this out loud as recently as yesterday, there are guys like Sidán Rafaela, Wilder Abreu, who they debuted last year, but they played very briefly. They played a lot of different positions. And this year is really their first taste of the majors. Also saw this with Tristan Casas. Last year was his first full season in the majors. And he had a very Dustin Pedroia-esque start to the season. Started off really cold, heated up May, June, finished the year as the third American League Rookie of the Year candidate. So you have a lot of Red Sox players who are figuring it out now, and you're seeing that come together in a really exciting way.
Alex Cora used the term, and this was in your piece at the Boston Herald yesterday, the team is playing with joy. And that is something that's nice to hear. It's cool to hear. One of those things you can feel when you're watching a baseball team or a team in any sport. What does that mean? And I mean, how much, you know, you mentioned it, they gave a lot of these young guys some time and some patience. And now that things are clicking, how much do you sense the confidence level growing in this pretty young group?
You know, the only thing I can really compare it to is how it felt last year when things were going completely the other way. The energy is really good. The energy was also really good in spring training, which is why it was frustrating to see everybody writing them off, because of course, front office and ownership issues should never supersede or overshadow the actual players on the field because they don't really have a say in what's happening. And the Red Sox, you've seen that with the Red Sox the last several seasons because they've had players publicly calling for help at the trade deadline, not getting it. And last year, you know, they, as things started to get bad down the stretch, September specifically, you know, they'd been kind of in it. They were like six-ish games out of a wild card spot as late as the end of August. And as things started to kind of circle the drain, you just feel the energy change of, okay, well, we're kind of just riding it out now. And so the polar opposite is happening right now where, you know, they seem to genuinely like each other. These guys are friends. They hang out on days off and they pick each other up. They support each other. So the energy is really good and they are playing with joy and it's refreshing because baseball should be fun. You should see every team at least part of the season, at least start the season playing with joy. Obviously things aren't going to go perfectly for every team every year, but it's very exciting to cover a team that has something kind of gelling for them and seeing that play out on the field, seeing these guys put together these 13-game hitting streaks, setting records that literally haven't been matched since like the first season in Red Sox history in 1901. It's exciting. It's fun.
One of those records you mentioned is that David Hamilton and Jaron Duran are the first Sox teammates to have 20 stolen bases each at the midway point since 1901. The Red Sox are now up to fourth in stolen bases in the league. We obviously saw what they did to the Yankees a couple weeks ago. They ran a little bit on the Blue Jays, but they kept hitting home runs, and you don't need to steal bases that much if Tyler O'Neill's hitting a home run every time he comes up. How much fun has that element of this been for the Red Sox, the fact that they are one of the more aggressive teams on the bases and really seem to make opponents uncomfortable?
You know, it's not just that they're aggressive, it's that they're running well. Because, you know, the Red Sox just spent the weekend in Cincinnati, and yes, the Reds lead the majors in stolen bases, and Ellie De La Cruz is an incredible talent, and he's leading all major league players like individually in stolen bases. But you also see a lot of base running mistakes from the Reds, and the Red Sox, they've had base running mistakes. But for the most part, you know, Duran over his 13-game hitting streak, or Duran since the start of June has, I think, 10 stolen bases or something like that. Or he's 9 for 10 in stolen base opportunities. So it's not just that they're stealing. It's not just that they're putting the pressure on and that they're racking up the steals. It's that the way that they're doing it is in a like an expertly done way. So you know that when Duran or Hamilton or Rafaela is kind of getting that jump, they're probably going to end up where they're trying to go. And that creates the kind of pressure that the Red Sox haven't been able to really put on opponents for a really long time. I mean, they've not been a real big stolen base team in their history. Like, if you look at the numbers, their biggest stolen bases seasons were in the early 1900s. And then, you know, there were years where they weren't collectively, there were full decades where they weren't stealing 100 bases together. And now you've got guys that are just racking them up. And it's when you're not able to hit home runs, where they've had stretches they're not doing that, or where you're having stretches where your pitching is struggling or you've got a lot of injuries, the ability to create pressure in a different way is a game-changing variable for a team that isn't always going to fire on all cylinders, but they can rely on the fact that these players have that speed. If they can get on base, they can make something happen.
Whereas if you're the Blue Jays, you're 28th in home runs and 24th in stolen bases, and you don't do good at the other base running stuff, it's tough. With respect to Duran Gabriel, he has, in addition to the 22 or to the 20 stolen bases, you know, hit a handful of home runs. He's hitting .288, very good defense in the outfield. How certain are we that he's headed to an all-star game here in a couple weeks?
I mean, he should be. There are few players, few position players, few outfielders who have made as strong of a case for the All-Star game as Jaron Duran. Even just in June alone, he's hitting over 300, well over 300. He's homered multiple times. He's doing everything. You know, he's making those incredible catches. He's one of the, I think it's him and Dalton Varsho are two of the top outs above average outfielders in the majors. And he's got the speed. He's basically figured out how to become a complete player. And it's because he works incredibly hard and he plays with joy. And that is the kind of energy that you want in the All-Star game. Never mind the fact that the numbers back it up. I just pulled it up and he's hitting 384 in June with a 1.083 OPS, 9 for 10 in stolen bases, 13 RBI, 4 home run. He's leading the majors in triples, by the way, which is kind of a weird stat, but he has 10 triples. There are teams that don't have 10 triples cumulatively. So, yeah.
That's a lot of fun. I love triples. I hate, like, one of the things, and look, Rogers Center's done a lot of nice jobs, like changing the dimensions and making it feel more like a ballpark and stuff like that. But it's never been a very big triples ballpark. We just don't get to see them here very often. The Jays are one of the teams that doesn't have 10 triples as a team. I love a triple, a guy just on his horse out of the batter's box, making it go. It's a lot of fun. Tyler O'Neill's also been a lot of fun. He just killed the Jays. Obviously a Canadian guy, so in non-Jays games, we're rooting for him here. How big has that been to this Red Sox offense? You mentioned they don't hit a ton of home runs necessarily, but he's a guy who's really been able, when healthy, been able to add that element to the middle of the order for them.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is that 15 home runs is already the second highest total of any season in his career, and that's with him only playing 54 games. So, you know, you've got a guy who can be a real game changer when he's healthy. And fortunately, he has managed mostly to stay healthy. He also is really fun to watch in the outfield. I remember in spring training, he was showing the other guys how he can kind of do that, like, flip throw where he basically does like a front flip while throwing the ball. So the cannon is fun. It brings kind of like a theatrical element and also just a great clubhouse presence. You know, it's a team full of likable guys where they get along, they have fun together, they enjoy playing together. And, you know, Red Sox fans in particular have seen over the years that those kind of environments, those intangibles, they do make a big difference. You know, you have the 2004 Red Sox, it's the 20th anniversary. That's a team famous for a stolen base and for crazy energy and fun energy. I mean, their nickname was the Idiots. And, you know, when you ask those players who were around on opening day, like, what was the difference? It's like, well, we just really liked playing together. We loved playing together. We wanted to, you know, just have fun together, and they didn't take themselves too seriously. And they did something no other team had done for them in 86 years and that no other team has done in the postseason in baseball history. So a lot of times with Boston, energy makes a huge difference. And fans can sense it too, because all Red Sox fans really want is to know that the team that they love and support like shows them a little bit of love back and talks. And, you know, when you hear them talk to us, that they're saying, you know, they're praising fans for showing up and for bringing the energy and stuff. And these guys, they say all those things and they appreciate having fans come around and, you know, show up for them, especially since there have been 3 losing seasons in the last 4 years.
Yeah. And look, if you're the city of Boston as a whole, you haven't won a championship in almost a week as a city. Yeah, so
it's been a really rough week, honestly.
Okay. Tanner Houck's going to start tonight for the Red Sox. He's kind of emerged for them as like a real ace, a real front of the rotation guy. What's gone into, I know he's like trimmed the walks and like the quality of the stuff is up and things like that. But you know, what has gone into him being able to take this step? They were pretty patient with him, you know, bullpen, starter, taking his time. It does seem to have clicked here for him this year.
You know, I wouldn't necessarily agree that they were patient with him so much as he has had to prove himself for the rotation basically every single year. He came up as a starter. He debuted as a starter in 2020. I think he made three starts and he was excellent against, I believe, the Marlins, Braves, and Yankees. I want to say, I mean, he was facing difficult teams in a very weird season also. And then in 2021, he's kind of used in multiple roles, and the same thing for 2022. He's had, you know, some surgeries and injuries. He had this freak injury last year. He was actually in the middle of one of his best starts of the season. He gets smoked in the face by a line drive, I think Kyle Higashioka maybe, and that kind of derailed what was a really promising start to the season, where he was the guy last year. Even if he was giving up too many earned runs, he was the guy that was going deeper into games than Chris Sale and Corey Kluber. But every year he's had to prove that he can be a starter. And this year, again, spring training, he was told to come to spring training to build up as a starter, even though he didn't have a solidified role in the rotation. And so part of it, I think, is he's just older and he's, you know, developed as a pitcher more, but also he's a guy that now knows that he's a starter for a team and he had this reputation as like, this guy can't go through the order the third time. This guy can't go deep into games. This guy throws too many pitches by the fifth inning. You know, he's not doing enough. And I think, like I said about the younger guys at the beginning, a lot of it is you gotta give guys time to develop. And he's had a lot of that time, but part of it is it's hard to develop when you're moving around your role, when your role is being switched up a lot. And he's admitted to that. He's, in retrospect, I talked to him about this recently after his Maddox game. He is grateful that he got to try all of these different roles, you know, long relief, late inning work, starting, but it is hard when you're not sure what you're going to do to prepare and to be consistent. And also just for the pitching staff in general, Andrew Bailey has been incredible, you know, especially for a franchise that historically has struggled with pitching so much. It's really been a marvel, and the guys love working with him. And like, that's been a game changer, because there are times where the offense is not going to be offending. Let's just put it that way, the opposing pitching. And, you know, you've got guys who are going 6-7 innings. The Red Sox have not had that since 2018. Basically they had some of that in 2021, but you do see the very clear difference between their four championship seasons and the other seasons is pitching. When they have pitching, they win games.
Yeah, it's cool to see from afar, as much as I don't, you know, as obviously competitively you don't love to see it, but it is cool to see the impact that Andrew Bailey has had. You know, the Tanner Houck, a good example of the, well, ditch the four seamer, let's go sinker cutter, let's try that out a little bit more, let's focus on what you do best and that kind of thing. And that's great context there, where, you know, from, like I said, from afar, it kind of, maybe it looks like, oh, they've been patient, they've given him a couple shots in the rotation. When you're in there every day, it's no, actually he hasn't got a chance to run with the role, and that's maybe what's helped things click. So thank you for that. Thank you so much for taking the time out this morning, Gabriel.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Gabriel Starr of the Boston Herald, Red Sox, Jays getting going today. Again, it's TBAs for the Jays, but we anticipate it being Chris Bassitt, Kevin Gausman, and Yariel Rodriguez staying on turn. The Jays haven't had an off day. This is a stretch of 17 game days in a row, so you can't do a lot of juggling and stuff there anyway. On the Red Sox side, Tanner Houck, Brian Baio, Cutter Crawford. Tanner Houck and Brian Baio, who we saw last time through. Cutter Crawford, who we did not. Tanner Houck, Jays actually did fairly well to get him out of that game. He gave up three, only two earned over 5 2/3. Jays got to him for six hits and two walks. That's nothing crazy, but A, by the standards of what Tanner Houck's allowed this year, that's not bad. And B, by the standard of what the Blue Jays have done to other pitchers, hey, three runs over 5 2/3 innings, you're doing Tyler O'Neill front flips if you're getting three runs in 5 2/3 innings if you're this Blue Jays team right now. They did hit some home runs over the weekend. Obviously, they didn't win any of those games. They are still at a minus 37 home run differential on the season, which trails only the Tampa Bay Rays. So there you go. If you think OPS is too much of an analytics, they're also really bad at home runs. They've been out homered by 37 on the year. There's a question about the home run differential, by the way, in the text line. We'll get to that in the second hour here. You could text us to 590-590 if you would like. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll go down to the farm. We'll talk to Doug Fox of the Future Blue Jays newsletter. We could have talked to him about Aroldis Martinez. Not so much anymore. We'll get to know Stuart Baroa. Riley Tirada is one of the hottest hitters in the Blue Jays minor league system, by the way. He has been crushing it at AAA. We'll talk about all that with Doug Fox as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That is The Future is a Foreign Land. We're going to talk the future with Doug Fox of Future Blue Jays newsletter. But first, Gabrielle dug the knife in a little bit on her way out there and let me know that not only do you have to potentially watch the ice-cold Blue Jays against the red-hot Red Sox at Fenway tonight, the Boston Celtics are bringing the Larry O'Brien to that game as well. So you're going to have to catch glimpses of that on the broadcast probably too. To our Sportsnet television producers, do not show me that tonight. I have no interest in seeing that. I know a lot of eyes will be on the Edmonton Oilers tonight as well. But yeah, don't show me the other champion. You can show me the Oilers if they win, although the Jays game will be long done at that point. No shots of Jason Tatum and those guys at the Red Sox game, please and thank you. Let's look to the future. Let's tag in Doug Fox of the Future Blue Jays newsletter over at Beehive. Doug, good morning. Thank you for doing this. How was the weekend, man?
Blake, the weekend was good. Thank you very much. And don't you feel like people who tune into the Jays and Red Sox tonight are a little bit like people who cheered for the Lions versus the Christians?
Yeah, it's not a good one, man. Although, you know, who knows? Things change quickly. The Jays were down in the dumps last year and then swept the Red Sox in Fenway the Davis Schneider weekend, which ended up in retrospect being like the highlight of the season. So slight holding out hope that maybe things can turn around a little bit here. Doug, let's start on a negative before we look at some positives around this minor league system right now. Aroldis Martinez got the call last week. We didn't get to talk to you about it, but we have spoke to you about Aroldis Martinez in the past. You know very well how these things go when players are kind of out of games for a long stretch here. For anyone who doesn't know, Aroldis Martinez is on the restricted list now, 80 games where he can't be in game action, but he can be down at the complex. It's, you know, functionally like being on the developmental list where you can do batting practice and work out and things like that, but you can't be in games. How much does something like a PED suspension for a prospect affect, you know, what the standing is in the org maybe, but like what do these next 80 games look like developmentally, Doug?
It's a blow. Let's not forget that he also lost a minor league season 4 years ago. And so he has always been behind the eight ball and developmental terms a little bit. And this is just leaving me shaking my head. Yes, he's going to work out with the big league complex, and he will get further tutoring from the staff there. But he's not going to face live pitching, and he's going to miss the rest of the minor league season. Six games, I think, left in the Blue Jays season. And let's face it, if they're out of it, those six games are not going to mean a lot, whether he plays or not. And if they're in it by some miracle, they're certainly not going to want to give it back to a guy who hasn't faced live pitching in 2 months. So it's a really unfortunate situation. And we'll leave out judgments aside. These guys have so many resources available to them, especially in the Blue Jays organization. They had quite a problem with PEDs and suspensions prior to COVID, and they quietly but very effectively did a very good job of taking care of that. And things in Latin America are very, very complicated, to say the least. But to see this happen now, it's really, really unfortunate, and it's quite a step backward in development, I think.
Yeah, and you hope that, you know, for Aroldis, it's a learning opportunity and doesn't do too much to him long-term developmentally. And you hope, yeah, lesson learned elsewhere in the organization as Major League Baseball and the MLBPA, and yes, the Blue Jays separately, try to continue to educate players both in Latin America and the United States about the risks of these things and how to avoid, you know, accidental positives and things like that. So, Doug, let's spin to the more positive side now. Aurelvis, having been tucked away for 80 games, because he hit the restricted list and Bo Bichette wasn't quite ready to come off the IL yet or eligible, Stuart Baroa got his call up. He's a guy, I don't know if you and I have talked about him on air. We've definitely DM'd about him before, but a really fun season, 25-year-old outfielder with some speed. Obviously, Baroa is not going to be up very long here. It sounds like he'd probably be the corresponding move when Bo Bichette is back, if he's back on Tuesday. They talked about him yesterday as like, hey, a pinch runner, defensive replacement, kind of. But bigger picture, what has Baroa been able to do at AAA this year to kind of improve his longer-term outlook as a prospect?
Well, he's always been something of a slap hitter. The pop was really slow to development, and not that he's a home run threat, but he's certainly, he's hitting the ball with more authority. He's showing better recognition of pitches at the plate. He's putting more balls in play, and that just plays up to his speed, which is a legitimate weapon on the base path. So I think long-term, he profiles more as a fourth outfielder, a guy who could really possibly be a Kevin Kiermaier down the line. I think his defense is that good. But it's so great. He's been in the organization a long time, and it's just a reminder that development is, for most guys, it's a very long process. But he has a real joy for the game, a real enthusiasm. I was just talking with somebody this morning whose 10-year-old kid was thrilled to see him called up because Stewart tossed him a ball in Scranton this week. So he's that kind of guy.
Well, that's really fun. And yeah, it seemed like he was having a good time pretty quickly there with the Blue Jays. So that's fun to see, even if, you know, the outlook is kind of fourth outfielder type. That's still a really valuable guy to have, especially if, you know, hey, someone with a glove and base stealing ability is not something the Jays have a ton of, at least high in the minors, especially with Cam Eden's bat not really, playing to that level. So one of Stuart Baroa's teammates in the weekend, and Baroa got pulled out of a game where he had a couple hits. He was actually on base when he got the call. We thought at the time maybe it was Dalton Varsho back injury related. Who knows? Mm-hmm. In that game, the Bisons end up scoring like 250 runs. They have had like a ton of crazy scores a lot of late. And one of the guys really contributing to that is another guy who hasn't really been on the prospect radar. It's Riley Tirada, who was a 12th round pick back in 2021. Very small signing bonus. Started this year, you know, A and then double A, now up to triple A. What can you tell us about Tirada and what has clicked here for him at age 25 at triple A?
That's a very good question. He's I think about to eclipse his season high of home runs before the a career high of home runs before the end of June. And he's one of those guys, and you and I have talked about before, that the Blue Jays have really shown a preference since COVID for drafting guys with that bat-to-ball profile, and he fits that very well. Not a lot of power for a corner guy, but he hit 7 home runs this month. And he's far and away by, I think, like about 200 points. I was looking the other day, the leader in the organization for OPS for the month. So it's great to see. There isn't a history there that suggests that this is sustainable. But this is a guy who works the strike, works the count, can draw walks, puts balls in play, and who knows, maybe he has just unlocked the secret for some launch angle exit velo, and we'll be watching more closely for the rest of the summer with him. But he's also going to be 26 years old in August. And so, you know, you have to factor that in as well.
Yeah. And stop me if you heard this one about a Blue Jays prospect, but he plays first, third, and right, and has also played second and left. Some positional versatility here too. But Doug, do you have a sense of like, what is, I assume based on how often he's played there, third is probably his strongest position. But is he like that versatility in the minors, is that something that could carry to the major? Like, is the glove enough, or is that still kind of TBD given how much he's bounced around?
I think it's still the bat is still the question. Despite the number he's putting up now, he's a very adequate defender at those two spots in particular, where he spent most of the season. They really seem to have focused on him there, as opposed to playing several more positions as he has in the past.
So we talked last time you and I talked, Doug, was 2 weeks ago now, and we were kind of kicking around, hey, who's due to get promoted in the minor league system? Who's ready for a new challenge? And one of the names you mentioned was Alan Roden. And then like the second we hung up, Alan Roden got promoted to AAA. He's only played in 3 games because he dealt with a quad or a hamstring thing for a couple days there. But what are you looking for from Roden as he makes this jump? He's probably, you know, if you're a Jays fan that checks out the box scores of the minor league teams every day, as I do, Roden's probably the top name you're curious about at AAA at this point.
Roden is a guy that I have liked for quite a long time, as you know. A little bit slow to make the adjustment to AAA, had the injury as well, but now that hopefully he's healthy, I see he hit a home run this weekend. He's made a lot of adjustments to his batting stance, and I look forward to seeing if he could just continue to hit number one, and then see if that starts to translate into some extra base power. Like, we're so enthused by the weekend Spencer Horowitz had, and maybe we have another player, maybe a different profile defensively, but maybe we've got another guy with a similar profile at the plate. So really looking forward to seeing him at a good long stretch at AAA to see what he can do. And who knows, maybe he's a guy we see later in the season.
Yeah, he's a potential guy. You know, certainly if the Jays went down the path of selling and going toward more of a youth movement the rest of the way, he's an interesting prospect. Someone else who's interesting, and Leo Jimenez, had he not been on the concussion IL, I wonder if he maybe would have gotten the call in Arelvis' spot when Bobichet hit the IL because of the defense, because they want Arelvis playing every day, etc. Obviously, Arelvis is now not in the picture because of the suspension. If the Jays have a need in the infield again the rest of the way, how ready do you think Leo Jimenez is to step up into a major league bench role, given the progression we've seen on the hitting side this year?
Now his numbers are a little inflated by a week in Scranton. We could all use a week in Scranton if it does that to our average, but he has to be the next guy up. And I agree, if not for his injury, I think he was the guy who would have come up for an addition instead of Arelvis. He's also out of options after this year, so the Blue Jays really need to see very soon what they have in him. So I suspect if there is another opening, or maybe both stint on the IL lasts longer than we think it's going to, maybe he's the guy that you're going to see next. But it's definitely Fisher cut bait time, I think, for the Blue Jays with him in terms of his prospect status.
Okay, so that's a lot of hitters on the Bison side, and that's kind of been the story of the Blue Jays minor leagues the last couple of years, is we're only talking about hitters at the higher levels of the minors. Buffalo, though, getting some additional bodies in now around AAA. We haven't seen James Kerpillion yet, but they signed him. They are on the path to getting Ricky Tiedemann back. He made a rehab appearance on Thursday at Single A. Chad Dallas made his return. Eric Pardino's up, and so on and so on. But a name that I wanted to ask you about first is a guy who's been there a good chunk of last year and all of this year, that maybe this is my fault, we haven't given him a ton of lip service. Maybe it's because he's 27 and was a non-prospect and things like that. But Andrew Bash has been basically the only really good steady starter for this AAA Bisons team. 3.69 ERA over 53 innings. He had a really good earned run average there in the second half of the year when he was kind of a swingman between the bullpen and the starting rotation last year. You know, we can look at the surface stats and, okay, a lot of fly balls, probably too many walks, etc. But we're now in a couple years of, hey, this guy just keeps producing. What do you make of Andrew Bash at this point?
Andrew Bash is a great success story. And in my last newsletter, as you know, I spoke with Blue Jays minor league pitching coordinator Corey Popham. And he was a guy I didn't wind up writing about, putting it in my newsletter, and I kicked myself a little bit. But Bash was a guy Corey mentioned. Like, this is a guy who was pitching an indie ball a little over a year ago, and the Blue Jays have brought him along, and he's been a mainstay in Buffalo's rotation. Velocity is dropping a little bit, but he's still a guy who throws in the low 90s. And if the Blue Jays were looking for somebody, if there was a fifth starter that they needed or somebody for an emergency start, I think that he's earned it. He throws a four-pitch mix, and he's been very effective in AAA.
So you mentioned you did chat with Blue Jays minor league pitching coordinator Corey Popham. You wrote about it in the Future Blue Jays newsletter that people can find on your Twitter or on your Beehive newsletter account. And I know you went into some specific guys. We can touch on those guys as well. But at a higher level, you know, organizationally, philosophically, what did you come away from that interview with Corey Popham thinking or feeling or having learned about how the Blue Jays handle their minor league pitching and where their kind of philosophy is with that?
I think there's very, very much a plan in place. There are goals that are set with the players' input at the beginning of the year, and there are boxes that they have to check. And I know somebody will see, fans will see Adam Macko with three straight strong starts in a row and say, move him up. And that's only one part of the picture. And so I think in the case, like a guy like Trenton Wallace, who you and I have talked about before, and who just seems to, you look up in six innings, one hit or one run, eight strikeouts, getting right-handed hitters out is kind of the next step for him. What tool is he going to use? What pitch is he going to develop more effectively? And more often than not, it seems a changeup. That was a theme that kind of came along quite a few times in my conversation with Corey. So they're definitely, there's a plan in place for all of these guys, and they have to kind of check all the boxes. They've got to hit all the benchmarks before they move up to the next level. Having said that, I think we're on the verge this week. You know, minor leagues hit their halfway point this past week. So I think we're on the verge of seeing some movement in the system very shortly.
So Trenton Wallace could be one who would go from AA to AAA. I think if they do that, Ryan Jennings from Vancouver, a natural guy to slide up into that spot in AA. And then are we looking at Jaron Watts-Brown from Dunedin to Vancouver? Is that kind of on the starting pitching side, the cascade there that you see happening?
Definitely. And I would think a guy like Fernando Perez, who's 20 years old and is pitching so well in the Florida State League, maybe it's time for him to move up as well. We have to keep in mind that the openings have to be created, mm-hmm. I guess, at each level. But on the other hand, if you're pitching well enough, they're going to find room for you. They're going to find a spot for you to pitch. So I'm really hoping for the Vancouver fans, especially, that they did not have a strong first half, and that's the franchise that's so well supported by their fans. I'm hoping that we see maybe an airlift of some arms for them for the second half.
So you mentioned Perez, and we've talked about Jaron Watts-Brown a bunch as a higher pick not that long ago. Fernando Perez, an international signing who, you know, last year he pitched in the Complex League only, and we saw these really good numbers, but we don't get video of the Complex League, right? We can only go off of, you know, the conversations you're having or what scouts of Baseball America are telling us or whatever. We're now seeing it. We can get our eyes on him at Dunedin, and he's a young 22. Like he's closer to 20 than 21, and he has a 3.74 ERA. He's made 12 starts, so he's starting pretty much every turn, going five innings a start. It really does, you know, feel like that's a pretty advanced profile for a guy who, you know, is freshly turned 20. Is that a fair read with Perez?
Absolutely. And he is a pounder of the strike zone. He's walked only 19 in 65 innings. He attacks hitters. He has got a curveball that's quickly becoming one of the best in the organization and learning to trust it more. He's going to be really, really special. And you're right. I think given his age, the Blue Jays are going to take things very, very carefully with him. But I'm already trying to keep myself from calling him El Presidente because he's a Nicaraguan from kind of off the beaten scouting path, struck out better than a batter in inning. But when his starts are on, he's for me, he's must see TV.
Okay. So someone who was on that list for you in recent years, I know, Diane Santos, we haven't seen him since I think Canada Day last year with the Vancouver Canadiens. Huge loss for them. They managed to win the championship no matter what, title across the waist there. He finally, Diane Santos, that is, finally got back into a game. He's another guy that, like Perez, was like pitching above level for his age. He was in high A ball at 20 last year. So a setback here with the injury, but he's back at 21. He made a Complex League rehab appearance out of the bullpen on the weekend. What are we looking at with Diane Santos when it comes to, you know, where he's going to land when he's back healthy and where our expectations levels should be?
He's been an interesting one. Missed the last half of last season and apparently had, reading between the lines, some setbacks in the off season. And whether that meant he didn't come to camp in good enough shape, I'm not sure what it was. But all the indications had been last fall that he would be good to go at the start of the season. And here he is now, halfway through, finally getting into action. And it has not been pretty. He got pounded with Dunedin yesterday, left the ball up. I think once he's got himself right and around, he has one of the best sliders in the organization. But I'm wondering if the Blue Jays are finally going to decide. He was left exposed to the Rule 5 last year, and maybe because of his injury history will again this year. But the talk all along has been the idea of moving him into a bullpen role with that fastball-slider combination. And I wonder if that's what we're going to see moving forward. He's still going to need a few more rehab outings to iron the bugs out. But if he's healthy, this is another exciting guy that they can add to that bullpen, maybe in New Hampshire.
Yeah, wow. That would be a big jump, but a help there, because we've talked about, like we said, a bunch of guys getting called up from AA to AAA for the bullpen because the Bisons have been so thinned out there. You mentioned that the Vancouver Canadiens, that's the High A Northwest League, they haven't had the best of starts to this season. Hopefully better things ahead in the second half. They've had a couple pitchers with real good performances of late, though. Lazaro Estrada threw a no-hitter, and then Rafael Sanchez struck out 12 on the weekend. When you look at that Canadiens team, do you think there's enough there if they get a couple Dunedin guys to kind of make that second half push that you're hoping for?
They could use a few more arms, and they certainly need some more bats. I think that's been a difficult time. From people that connected with the C's that I talked to, they just say they haven't played good ball for the first half of the season. So it will be interesting to see. We will get an airlift of some guys. There's not a whole lot of guys who are going to be able to help them. But they're just looking now. I think they are towards the bottom in OPS and a whole bunch of other offensive stats. So it's really, yeah, they could use some pitching. They could use some hitting. The Seas fans have been pretty spoiled for the last couple of years. Maybe this addition's bringing things back down to earth a little bit.
All right, I'm going to reach a little further down into the minors, but because the draft is coming up, let's talk about the player the Jays picked at number 20 last year. They have number 20 again this year, by the way. Arjun Namala, very, very young. He would still be one of the youngest prep prospects in this coming draft, so no need to worry too much about the numbers or anything like that yet. He did appear in 9 games in the Complex League last year after being drafted. This year, the Jays decided to really challenge him with a start at Dunedin. He played 20 or 30 games in Dunedin and then went on the developmental list for a while. So working out of that complex in Dunedin, he's now back, but he's back in the Complex League, not at Single A Dunedin. What have you made of the year that Namala's had? Recognizing, again, we don't get to see these Complex League games. We don't really know what happens when guys are on the developmental list. But that process of, hey, we're going to challenge him early and then scale it back and put him in a league environment where maybe he's better suited.
Really surprising with the assignment. And again, this is something you and I have talked about. And I've learned that there was actually quite a bit of debate in the organization about whether to start him in full season ball or not, which is a little bit unusual because that's usually more of a consensus thing. So I am hoping to speak with Farm Director Joe Scalfani in the next couple of weeks. And that will probably be one of the first questions that I ask. But you know what? It happens. You see enough from a guy, and certainly in spring training, his tools were very, on both sides of the ball, were very obvious. And so it's understandable why they gave him that aggressive assignment on the one hand. On the other hand, you do worry, everybody's going to have some failure. It's a game of failure, and it's a matter of how players react to that adversity. So would the plan have been all along, especially with the Complex League starting in May now, as it did this year, would it not have been better just to keep him in extended for a month, let him have a good start, and maybe he would be in Dunedin by now? Who knows? And there are lots of reasons that we don't know about this, but he's regrouping, I guess. And as you say, I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that he is so young and there still is so much time for him in development. And maybe some of this is the pressure that farm directors were feeling at the beginning of the year, because under the new CBA rules, teams are limited in how many players they can have under contract in the minor leagues at any one time. And so some difficult decisions had to be made, and maybe, who knows, maybe that was part of this process, maybe not. But he's in the lineup today in a Complex League game, and I think that's just a good place to leave him for the next little while.
Yeah, that Dunedin team, a lot of fun, but not a ton of guys hitting the ball there particularly well. You know, you've got Gene Joseph, who obviously defensively is really fun. Yoangel Aponte, who I think just hit the IL, and then Victor Arias, who is the one guy who has been hitting down there. Doug, I know you've said before that's like your favorite outfield in the system, maybe in the in any level of the minor leagues for the Blue Jays in years.
Definitely, ball hawks. Is what I call them. And there are two now. There was a third, Yoangel Aponte, who's back in the complex league. But Victor Arias, who I've said to me before that scouts have said looks like an NFL safety. and Joseph made a highlight reel catch yesterday. And then I think two batters later, Arias made an incredible shoestring catch. The offense is a little bit slow to come along. But you also have to remember, this is the Florida State League. Where I believe right now the league-leading average among teams is the Tigers affiliate, and that's a 245 average. So it's certainly much of a more pitcher-friendly with the bigger parks. The humid Florida air is certainly a much more pitcher-friendly league. So any numbers that we look at, we kind of have to maybe take with a grain of salt. But those two and Aponte as well are really exciting. Be really interesting to watch the development. Of course, he's still so far away, but it's been fun. I like keep coming back as I like watching Dunedin play this year.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you're having fun with it. I don't get to check out as much of it as I would like, but always like hearing your breakdowns of it. Always like reading your newsletter, Doug. Thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. Really appreciate it, and great chat with Corey Popham in the latest episode of your newsletter.
Blake, thanks so much. Great to talk to you.
Doug Fox, the Future Blue Jays newsletter on Beehive. Make sure you're subscribed to that. You can also follow Doug on Twitter at DMFox705. Always lots of great stuff on the Jays minor league system. We're going to take a break. When we go back, unfortunately, we're going to talk about the major league team instead. We're also going to give you some tickets to a game this weekend for that Yankees series. So stick with us for that. We'll answer some of your texts to 590-590 in the text line. And we'll talk to Colton Hall, an MLB photographer who took just an unbelievable photo of Vlad in the CN Tower. I love talking to artistic people about their process, especially as it pertains to baseball. And yeah, we'll set you up for this Jays Red Sox series. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Nick Kiprios.
And I'm Justin Bourne.
We're diving deep into everything happening in Leafland and the biggest stories around the NHL.
Real Kipper and Bourne, weekdays from 4 to 6 on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little rise again. So let's try to pick the energy up here as the Jays head into a series with the Red Sox where they desperately need some wins. When they were last at home against the Boston Red Sox, you may have seen a very, very cool picture of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. In the City Connect jersey just outside of the dugout carrying his glove out to first base with the CN Tower lit in the background in the kind of City Connect-ish colors. It's a really terrific photo. It's made the rounds on a lot of different baseball social media pages. Vlad himself posted it. The photographer of that photo joins us now. It's Colton Hall. He's at Colton N. Hall on Instagram, CHSMS social media services as well. Colton, good morning, man. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, man. How's it going?
I am good. Man, what a shot. How's it been? That's got to be up there in terms of how well received a baseball photo has been in the social media era.
Like, it's crazy. The heart rate has been elevated all weekend. It's just surreal. It's great to have the recognition. You know, photography is crazy. Social media is crazy. Just, yeah, that's it.
Vlad can't tag you, though? What's wrong, man? Come on. He's got to give
you
that.
Though. He did.
Okay, good.
On the Instagram, yeah. So, like, working for the MLB, you know, we get the job is that, you know, we don't have recognition.
Yeah.
And that's part of the job. But when it does happen like this, it's crazy. It's just surreal.
So your job at MLB is a content capturer, basically, and that's photo, that's video. Can you walk us through, like, what a normal pregame and game day is like for you, what you're trying to get, where you're positioned on the field and stuff like that?
Yeah, so basically as a live content creator for MLB, we're there from 3:30 p.m. Basically to the end of the game. So 3 hours before the game, we're capturing BP, we're capturing both teams, any interactions between, you know, the Jays and the away team. Anything that's cool and that social media is going to pick up and they're going to love, and we fire it off pretty much right away. So like, I'll grab my phone, I plug in this little dongle, SD card goes in the phone, and within minutes, MLB, all the social channels, they have that content.
So you're mostly, I mean, we, for those who are watching on TV, they can see where you're positioned there, but you're in those down the baseline tunnels where we see our guy Ali Khan and stuff like that, and where Hazel will do her reports. So what do you, like, obviously the game's on and you're kind of focusing on the main things, but what are you trying to get? Like, what's front of mind for you? Like, hey, I'm going to watch for this. I got to keep my eye on this particular player or this. Like, you had that cool photo of Davis Schneider the other day where, like, the ball's just, like, the perfect right presentation in right in the center. Yeah. So, like, what are you looking for over the course of a game or over the course of a play? Are you just kind of doing a little bit of everything and see what clicks that day?
It's kind of like that's the hard part about the job, is that it's so fast paced. Sports, you know, you can't ask someone to pose for a photo. So when, you know, you kind of read the game and how it's going along, and you pick up on things. I mean, I've been doing this for 7 years, thankfully, grateful. You pick up on certain plays. So like, let's say there's one out, there's a man on first. If you're shooting from the first base side, chances are if it's a grounder, it's going to be a double play, and you're going to get a pretty cool shot of someone sliding into second, someone jumping over, throwing the ball. A lot of like the big names, you know, for Vladdy, we definitely focus on getting shots of him at bat. That's pretty much a given all the time. A lot of video as well. It just goes by however the game's going. It's like play by play. It's fly by the seat of your pants type of thing. And you just got to hang on and hope you get the shot.
And then I would imagine, like, even if you're very, very good at this job, as you clearly are, there's a lot of not a high percentage of what you take is going to end up being like the best photo or something that makes Vlad's Instagram and things like that, right?
No. So we take probably like 1,000, 1,500 photos a night, and maybe 5 to 10 of them are like really like, you're like, okay, cool, I nailed that.
Nice. Yeah. That's, I mean, hey, this is a game of failure, as they say. And certainly. No, that seems cool, man. So you mentioned you've been doing this for 7 years. So you're a Humber College creative photography grad. Did you always, like, when you went to photography school, was it always sports for you, or is this just kind of where you landed?
So it wasn't sports for me. When I was finishing my second year at Humber, my buddy of mine, he was working Jays 50-50 tickets, and he sent me a tweet, and it was the posting from MLB, and it said real-time correspondent was what the job was called. And he's like, you would be sick at this. You should try this out. And I applied, and I got the opportunity to work that first season while I was still finishing up second year of school, graduating. And then it kind of just stuck. And I mean, it's a great opportunity, so I'm just not trying to give it up anytime soon, right? So
yeah, no, it's, and you're obviously very good at it and have taken to the baseball side of it. So good timing and great work from your friend to pass that one along. Big assist there. So I know this is, I can't remember if this is pre-pandemic or after or whatever, but you've done some music photography as well. And based on your Instagram, I don't know, like, do you choose which concerts you're going to photograph? Because, like, we have some music overlap, if so. Some Rise Against, some Billy Talent kind of stuff in the Instagram profile.
Yeah, so, I mean, that actually is shot from the pit from me, like, on my phone. Like, I just go to the concerts myself.
Oh, okay, that wasn't as a photo.
There, but nice. I do some edits in Lightroom afterwards, make it look nice. But that's all just, that's myself. I'd love to shoot concerts. It's definitely on the bucket list. But, that's just me being a fan of those bands.
Nice. Better at taking the pit photo than I am, that's for sure. I'm a quick, like, I'll get one just in case, and then my phone's away the rest of the time. They don't turn out like a professional photographer, but I'm not putting them through Lightroom or anything like that either. So you mentioned that would be kind of a dream thing. Are there any other things like that? Like, is there a baseball player that you haven't got to shoot yet that you're really looking forward to, or, you know, a band or another athlete that would be top of the list for you?
Growing up with Rise Against and Billy Talent in my high school days, definitely loved those bands. That's my kind of music. Shooting something like that, like those guys, that'd be pretty sweet. City in Color would be another one.
Nice.
Shohei was on the list, except when he was in Toronto last, I did get a few photos of him, which was really cool. Yeah, just taking everything that comes and taking it day by day, and that's it.
That's great, man. Yeah, glad you got the Shohei ones. I mean, it's not City in Color, but Alexis are opening for Blink-182 at Rogers Center this summer, so they, like, you could still get the Dallas Green element of it if you really need.
I mean, if someone hands me a pass, for sure, I'll be there.
Yeah,
sure.
I'll ask around for you because I'm still looking for a pass for that one too.
Man,
Colton, thanks so much for taking the time out and sharing a bit about your story, man. Keep up all the great work. Glad to see your work getting as much love as it is. That photo of Vlad and all your stuff, really, really great stuff, man.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for the support from my family, friends, MLB, Blue Jays, everyone that's posted, reshared it. Yeah, it's a surreal moment.
Including Vlad himself. Always a good thing to make the subject of the photographs happy. That's Colton Hall. You can find him at Colton N. Hall on Instagram or on Twitter. A lot of really great photography work around the Blue Jays and for all of MLB. Okay, the Jays are going to play the Red Sox over the next couple days. The Jays are also going to play the Yankees this weekend for Canada Day long weekend. We want to send you. The Jays return home Thursday for Canada Day long weekend to lead off their final homestand before the All-Star break with matchups against the Yankees and the Astros. To help kick this off, we'll be giving away a pair of tickets to Friday's game against the Yankees. That's the 28th. To enter for a chance to win, text today's code word Yankees to 590-590. Again, today's code word is Yankees. They're really creative coming up with the code word for today. Text that into 590-590 right now to enter for your chance to win tickets to the game on Friday, June 28th. We're giving away another pair of tickets tomorrow and Wednesday, so make sure you stay locked in, tuned in, and fire off those code words. There'll be new code words the next couple of days. Lot from the weekend, obviously, with the Arelva suspension and the Blue Jays continuing to struggle. We're going to take some texts in the text line to 590-590 in a minute here. But as a reset, the Jays have lost six in a row. Before that road trip, we were talking about, hey, what would they have to do to get back to 500? You know, the proximity to the wild card race. You needed a couple in that stretch to not just get back to 500, but hey, the Red Sox were just ahead of you. You need to make sure you don't have to jump that team later. We look at the standings now, and not only have the Jays lost six in a row and slid, all of those teams that they had previously passed in the wild card race. And look, it doesn't really matter if you finish seventh in the wild card race or ninth in the wild card race or whatever. But at this point in the season, it's important to know how many teams you have to jump, because it's not just, oh, you have to outplay the Red Sox by 6.5 games the rest of the way. It's you have to outplay the Red Sox by 6.5, the Royals by 6, the Astros by 2.5, the Rays by 2.5, et cetera. And all of those teams have jumped the Blue Jays in the standings during this six-game losing streak. The only teams in the American League East with a worse record than the Jays are the Angels, the Athletics, and the White Sox. You never want to be in the same sentence with those three franchises, at least not in 2024. So they have made things exceptionally more difficult for themselves from here, and it's not going to get easier with Red Sox, Yankees, Astros this next little bit. Let's take the first text line question, which was actually from the weekend from Joe Wolfond, a friend of the show on Twitter. Maybe you've done this on the show already and I just missed it, but the Jays are on pace to finish with a negative 83 home run differential. I'd love to know where that ranks in franchise and recent Major League Baseball history. So the Jays shrunk that over the weekend a little bit because they hit 8 home runs, but the Jays have currently been out-homered by 37 home runs. The only team that has a bigger home run deficit is the Tampa Bay Rays. I put this request out to our friends at SportRadar. So the Jays are on pace to allow 78 more home runs than they hit. That would be the biggest home run gap in franchise history. You have to go back to 1979 for the record, where they got out-homered by 70. It would also be the 22nd worst all-time, which I realize isn't that high, but when you're the number 7 payroll in baseball and your goal was to not just make the playoffs, but like contend, and you're one of the like 25 worst teams of all time in terms of hitting and giving up home runs, that's pretty bad. It's also the second worst the Jays have ever been through this many games. Some crazy ones when you dig through the list. The Nationals over the last 2 years got out-homered by 212 home runs. The Twins from 1996 have the record at a minus 115 home run deficit. So home runs aren't everything, but in the current environment where offense is low, where batting average is the second lowest it's been in the entire history of baseball, you need home runs. And you can't be, you could probably survive as a playoff team not hitting a lot of home runs if you also stole bases and hit for average and things like that. You could probably survive giving up a bunch of home runs if you were a good offensive team or your pitching staff did everything else. There is no way to survive being a bad home run hitting team that also gives up a ton of home runs, and when you're also not doing all the other things well that you would need to do to survive that. So great question from Joe Wolf on ugly, ugly trend for the Blue Jays there in terms of home run differential. And again, it's not everything, but home runs certainly go a pretty long way. Always, but in the modern environment as well. Brad in Brantford asked, what am I supposed to make of this Aroldis suspension? Does it change how we view him as a prospect? I don't think so. Like, it's relevant information, obviously. He's a 22-year-old kid. So, you know, I assume that this question is more about the production and do we think of the production that he's put up differently? I think you keep it in mind. I'll have to talk to a few more scouting people. It doesn't seem like people have significantly downgraded Noel V. Marte in terms of his long-term outlook. You know, Aroldis is a more power-only oriented prospect, so maybe that's a factor there. There's also, you know, realistically, the size or muscle or strength that he's put on is already on. They don't take that away with the suspension. So that's probably something it's a very good question. It's something I'll probably have to talk to more people on the scouting side about, just exactly how that changes, you know, Aroldis's prospect standing or how we project his power moving forward. And then, yeah, if you're the organization, you know, there's a decision-making component there of hey, you got to make sure that this guy's making better decisions in the future, being forthright with the team about what supplements he's taking and things like that. Malcolm and Markham asks, who should be the fifth starter? Who's the favorite? I think it's Yariel right now until it's not. You could, at some point, swap Yariel and Bowden if you believe some of what Bowden's showing you over his last couple appearances is something he can build on. I wrote about Bowden Francis's new splitter on Friday. He's not going to throw it a ton in a bullpen role, but it's something that he's worked on to try to make it so that he can be a starter long-term. You know, a righty having that weapon against lefties is helpful. Seeing a guy a second time through the order have a fourth pitch to give him, that kind of thing. But I think for right now, it's probably Yariel with Bowden ready to do multiple innings out of the bullpen. Having said all that, the bullpen is in such thinned out disarray with so many fringe AAA guys at this point that nothing would really surprise me. Like, there's a chance, having used the bullpen for the, like, Yariel's start on Friday became basically a bullpen day. Kikuchi's start yesterday became basically a bullpen day because of the long rain delay. There's a chance that they have to do something roster-wise to change the makeup of the bullpen today. There's a chance that if Chris Bassett doesn't go very long into the game today, they have no choice but to use a Bowden Francis or even a Yariel Rodriguez or something like that to cover the innings and then figure it out after that. So I'd say right now it's Yariel, but yeah, when your bullpen's in this kind of shape and no one's run with the fifth starter job, it's always going to be fluid. Steven Toronto says, I miss Alex Anthopoulos for sad face. So do I. Good baseball executive, that guy, Alex Anthopoulos. You know, the Braves have had some bum luck over there this year, but generally a very well-run organization. And yeah, good point, Steve in Toronto. Fred in Belleville asks, is there even a point in adding players at the deadline? They're so far back and have a bunch of teams to jump. So if they get to a certain point back in the standings, yes. If they are at the trade deadline and they are 6.5 games out with 7 teams to jump, no, it's not going to make sense to add, really. I think right now, the only thing they'd probably entertain adding is bullpen help. And that's more because, like, they just don't have enough arms anyway. We'll see what the update is on Jordan Romano. We'll see what the timeline is for Jimmy Garcia to get back. Eric Swanson's not coming back anytime soon based on his performance at AAA. But no, Fred, like, this is why these next 20 games feel very big. And even if, like, short of them going 20-0, I realize that some fans are not going to believe in this team to be able to make noise in the playoffs and things like that, and I totally get it. But I will tell you, from the front office's perspective, they're going to give it these 20 games to see if they can turn it around, to see if they can hit a win streak, because they don't feel the need to sell today if they can turn around and sell on July 30th. So is there a point in adding players at the deadline if they're in this spot that they're in right now? No, they should be sellers. If that gap is more like one game and two teams to jump or something like that, it's a different conversation 20, 25 games from now. But the way things look right now, they would and they should and probably would be sellers. I just, if you are, what, 12th in the American League and the only teams worse than you are blatantly tanking or trying to hijack their franchises and are having sell the team chance at games and things like that, yeah, you're not in a position to be buyers. Because again, this is the number seven payroll. It's a bottom 10 farm system. They've underperformed at the major league level. Like, there's not a lot to be optimistic about and build on right now. They're going to give it these 20 games or so to see if they can, you know, luck into, or I was going to say regress, but like, it's not regressing at this, but getting a little bit better might be regressing toward the mean, but there are not a lot of underlying signs that say this team's been unlucky and it should turn around and things like that. All the underlying stuff that we talk about on this show has for the most part said, yeah, they're not a very good baseball team. So Fred, if they're in this spot on July 30th, no, they shouldn't buy. They should be sellers. We'll see where they are. Greg in Aurora says, if the Jays trade a major piece, who's most likely to go? It would be the guys who are on the final years of their deal. So Danny Jansen, Yusei Kikuchi, Jimmy Garcia, those are the big ones. You know, Justin Turner and Kevin Kiermaier would probably have places that want them. I don't know that you'd get a lot back beyond getting out of their salaries for the rest of the season, just given they're older vets and are probably going to play a part-time role wherever they're going. You know, maybe you get a fringy prospect, but, you know, remember back to Josh Donaldson. You got a player to be named later that turned into Julian Merriweather. Like, that's kind of the price tag for a veteran rental on an expiring contract late in the season. So I wouldn't set the bar too high for like the Turner, Kiermaier types. But yeah, Trevor Richards, Jimmy Garcia, Danny Jansen, Yusei Kikuchi, those would be the big ones because they're pending free agents. If you do a more dramatic blow up, which I can't see this front office doing, and I don't think they should be the ones to do it if you're going down the path of a more aggressive rebuild there. But yeah, I think you would at least entertain some of the bullpen names. You'd see, hey, if someone calls on a Kevin Gausman or Chris Bassett and they blow you away, you think about it. But if this team intends to contend again in 2025, you're going to want to maintain at least a good chunk of that starting pitching depth. Mike in Huntsville says, Stuart Broad looks like a Major League Baseball player with all his tools. Am I too intrigued by him? The hit tool still has a way to come. He has changed his swing so it's a little more line drive oriented. He does hit a lot of line drives. Given his speed, that's probably the better approach for him because he can run out some singles and things like that, and then he can use his wheels when he's on the bases. And he's a really good defender by all accounts in all three outfield spots. So that is a major league toolkit. The bat tool probably needs to continue to develop to where he's more than a fourth outfielder type. But yeah, there's enough to like there. He was very, very good at AAA this year. Scott in Peterborough asks, thoughts on IKF as the leadoff hitter? I don't know. They don't have enough guys hitting well right now. I personally probably would have had Horwitz in that spot over the weekend, but IKF has the nice bat-to-ball stuff. Obviously had a good weekend with a couple of home runs. You know, when the lineup's rolling over, that's a guy who can do some bat-to-ball stuff, some situational hitting stuff. They have no good options in the top four of the order right now. Like, there are only probably two players in Horwitz and Vlad who you'd really want to be hitting in the top four right now, Varsho against some righties. I pass the point where I really care that much. Put whoever's hot up there, whoever's having good at-bats, throw them up there. Get George Springer back down a little bit. But you don't have enough good players to be too nitpicky with the order right now. Jen and T.O. asks, how much is Danny Jansen's slide at the plate in June impacting his trade value? Same with Kikuchi's value. Probably a decent amount. Danny Jansen has like a four-year sample of being a very, very good hitter at the plate, and teams will know that. Teams will also know he hasn't played a full season in any of those times. That's probably the thing that more colors his value. We don't really know what a Danny Jansen market's going to look like in the offseason. Kikuchi's a little easier to measure because there just aren't impact starters that are going to be available on the trade market. There rarely are. If there are, you know, Kikuchi's going to be right near the top of the list. Maybe a team sees Kikuchi and they're like, yeah, to help us get there, and then he'd be our fourth, so maybe we want to use him out of the bullpen, you know, kind of what the Jays did in 2022, rather. I think he's exceeded beyond that. Yesterday was rough. There was also the rain delay and things like that. I think he'd still have a good amount of value. Someone who didn't side there said, how confident are you in Ross Atkins leading the retooling moving forward? If you haven't gotten the impression over the course of this season and last offseason, not very confident. I don't know how else to say it. I don't know how else to sugarcoat it. And I think it's one of the fundamental questions the Jays face over these next couple of weeks is it's been 8 years now. The group that got you into this situation, how is it, you know, intellectually, how do you also allow that group to pull you out of it? Or, you know, if they're lame duck status and their job security is up in the air after this season, which has obviously been a failure to date, you know, why is that the group stewarding this retool? It's a difficult thing. It's hard to change general managers in season because you can't do a full exhaustive search and things like that. But hard things are hard, and you got yourself in a very, very hard position here, and now you need to do what you need to do to get out of it. 7-10, Chris Bassett against Tanner Houck. Big lineup changes on the Sportsnet side. It'll be Dan, Joe, and Arden on the TV broadcast for you. Jamie and Caleb on Blue Jay Central. Ben and Chris on the radio. David Singh's down there for us covering it. Thank you to Shai Davidi for joining us, to Gabrielle Starr, to Doug Fox, to Colton Hall. Thank you to Andrew Adams and Michael Collins behind the glass, Amit Mann and Jennifer Rolnick. As always, we will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break this one down. Will it be a seventh consecutive loss? God, I hope not. And please don't show me the Boston Celtics celebrating while the Red Sox beat the Blue Jays at Fenway. I don't want to see it. I don't need it. Go Oilers, and have a great Monday, everyone.